see these advertisements in the subway for friend.com?
Yes. Although it's marketed as like a supportive device that helps you go throughout your day-to-day life and like gives you little prompts that they... It was programmed with the attitude of the company's CEO, who is a petulant asshole. No. So although it is friend, it's like a friend who's always condescending to you.
Oh, it's
but is like totally wrong about everything. And
we all know that friend. Yeah, they should call it that friend.
If you don't know that friend, it might be you.
It could be you. Yeah, if you're walking around like, why is everybody such a dick to me all the time? I always end up in these scenarios where people are like yelling at me and screaming at me. Spoiler, it might just be you. I don't want to try the friend pendant, but I do appreciate, and I posted to this effect earlier today, I do appreciate that every subway stop, including my own and the one that I get off for at work, people have defaced the friend.com advertising to say like, fuck AI slop, AI is death, AI is terrible, touched grass.
Yeah, and I've also noticed it's inspired people to deface other advertisements that are generated by AI.
Right, I saw that today too, yeah. You love to see it. It's either like some hidden secret cadre of people who are like maybe they read like Jason Sadowski's shit, or they're into like Big Black Jacobin, that guy, like really into Luddite shit, and they have like a secret cadre that's going around and planning the destruction of all of these advertisements. But I would like to believe that it's actually more spontaneous than that, that people are like, they just revile this technology in such a way that anybody with a Sharpie, you know, is going to deface these things because they're such an affront to humanity and to God. You know?
All right.
What do you want to do? You want to talk shutdown and stuff first, or?
Yeah, I think it might be good to talk about the shutdown. Obviously, we've seen this a few times before, and it's never really made any impact on my life, but obviously there's going to be a lot of knock-on effects of it the longer it continues. And from what I hear, it seems like the most major effect that at least might initially bring it to a quick end is that it's very bad for Wall Street and the markets.
Ah, yes.
And crucially, the Democrats' donors and the Republicans' donors, of course, the doning class. So
the doning class, yeah, those donors. So you think there's going to be pressure from capital to resolve this whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more obvious now than it ever had been that the conflict between the autonomy of the state as it centralizes in Trump and his circle is increasingly only really checked by capital, to some extent, of course, by people who are bravely countering ICE everywhere. That's something we could talk about as well. But if we're talking about government policy, I think really the only thing we can look for, since there's, you know, really only one party, is the fractures of capital. And so I think it's really interesting the way that's played out, at least rhetorically, in following the shutdown. Because shutdowns in the past, you know, what's the rhetoric been? This is bad for government employees. They're not going to get paid. They're going to get furloughed. People are going to stop getting...
That's already happened in this instance.
Yeah,
right?
People are going to stop getting benefit checks, that sort of thing. Now, that's already the policy of the Trump administration. So that's kind of redundant. So instead, what we're getting, the rhetoric around this, is the Democrats are saying, we are going to keep this shutdown going until healthcare is refunded to the level that it was defunded from the last spending bill, which is, I think, a very noble goal.
That's what the Democrats are saying to Trump. What are the Trumpists saying, and the Trump Trump types in Congress? What are they?
Everybody transgender. Yeah, their rhetoric is a total lie. It's that the Democrats are saying, we want you to give health care to illegals.
Oh, right. I think I heard about that. Like, they're claiming we spend $50 trillion a year on healthcare for illegals or something like that, right?
Yeah, and they claim, like, the negotiation is just the Democrats want healthcare for illegals because the illegals want to transition, and the Republicans only want healthcare for Americans. And
what a fucking farce. Holy shit.
Yeah, the Democrats are not exactly doing a good job of countering that message.
No, not at all. It's striking to me, and it's maybe something that I think I've mentioned on the show before, that immigration has almost become like the shibboleth for the MAGA right, for the Trumpist right, where it's like a single issue that can encompass everything. Like, every immigration touches on everything for them. And of course it does in a certain sense, but in their weird demonology, it's like the immigrant is this almost like this anti-Semitic caricature. It's like both these like violent, you know, marauding hordes that cross our borders to, like,
yeah, it's Camp of the Saints shit. They're, you know, and it's been consistent, of course. Like, the first thing Trump said when he started running for president is that they're rapists. But that message has only, you know, snowballed into this rhetoric that we're being invaded, and that's been used as justification for something like I was saying, you know, last year during the Trump campaign was metaphorically going to be a war on the working class, but it's turned out to be not metaphorical at all. You know, he spoke to the generals just last week and said, yeah, we're gonna have you guys train in the cities.
Yeah, I saw that. This is like, I've been thinking to myself, and I started this nice little job up the street at a local canal that you and I have, which is very polluted, but that I work and I go to, and I have a lot of time to think at work. And I think to myself, like, do I have any regrets? Should I have, like, been in the bag for Kamala? Should I have, like, not been so critical of Biden? Like, all the people that said for all this time, like, if you're not actively confronting Trump and supporting Biden and the Democrats, you're ushering in fascism, you know? And I was always very wary, of course, to go down that route. And I am, like, constitutionally unable to support Democrats. But I'm thinking to myself, like, were they all right? Like, this is the fascism that they were talking about. It's coming down the pipe. Is it my fault? Did we do this whole thing? And of course, I don't think that that's true, but like, we all kind of maybe need to pause a little bit and think about the consequences in this historical.
Well, you know, I think you could definitely say that in Trump's first term, where the Democrats at least appeared to put up something of a fight. Now we're seeing liberalism that is not able to put up a fight. So it's cold comfort, but we were fucked either way, and now the fucking is coming sooner than later. And so I mean, it would be so comforting, you know. I've been like, when I get fed up with the radical milieu in the past, it's been some comfort to me to be like, oh, maybe I should just be a liberal, but it doesn't make any sense anymore.
Let me try
to get back to the shutdown.
It's
really interesting that they're making healthcare the central issue, because obviously it's politically savvy, because it highlights the way the Trump administration and the Republicans are trying to give away what the American working class actually has, and not just the working class, you know, anyone who needs a rural hospital, for example,
right,
just trying to cut that and sell it off in exchange for military spending, that, you know, AI data centers, all this bullshit that Trump wants, war with Venezuela, you know, more bombs for Israel, you know, points in the direction of an actual talking point that the Democrats can get behind. But why don't they go harder on it? Why aren't they demanding more? Why aren't they saying things the way I'm saying it? It would be very populist for them. These are winning talking points. Why don't they do it? Is because they're in a dance with their donors who don't give a shit about that stuff. They just want the line to go back up. And that's not very likely as long as the government shut down.
Yeah, I think that's all correct. And I've heard some worrying rhetoric from people on, let's call them the libertarian right, people who are associated with say the U.S. military, people who are kind of like gold bug type libertarian economists. These people have been talking for my entire lifetime about hyperinflation coming and this, that, and the other thing. And so you always have to take what they say with a grain of salt, just like everybody else in capitalist media and capitalist politics. However, the case has been made, I think, pretty strongly that the butcher's bill is finally coming due on American debt. How many trillions of dollars, tens of trillions of dollars is it at this point? If only because a massive amount of that debt needs to be rolled over in the next year or so. And at the last several auctions for that debt, it's been kind of like this epochal moment in 1974 when New York City was able to over and over again roll over its municipal bonds like no problem. All the big players would show up in the room. They'd eat up these bonds like no problem. And then at this like incredible moment in 1974, nobody shows up to buy any bonds. And this is the beginning of the fiscal crisis. Now, I think they would caution, the people who are talking like this would say that this government shutdown that we're seeing right now, all the tariff stuff, all of the pulling back of the empire to the Western Hemisphere, all of the attempts to like grasp onto physical resources in Greenland or elsewhere is all part of this increasing worry on the part of the Trumpist parts of the ruling class, but the capitalist class in general about American debt levels. And these are things that we have always kind of for our lifetimes just said, oh, well, they'll work themselves out. American debt, American treasury bills. Everyone loves that shit. Those piggies will keep showing up at the trough. But I think that maybe this government shutdown, as much as there are segments of capital which see this chaos as not particularly good for business, I think maybe as a way to explain what the Democrats are, how they're reacting to this entire thing, there's a whole other swath of the capitalist class, which does not want to see the U.S. state go down. And they're kind of feeling like it's possible.
So would you call what happened in 1974 something like a capital strike?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, bonds, treasury bills, whatever it is, when they're going great, when there's a sufficient rate of return and there's a sense that they're, you know, the bondholders will be made whole at the end of this whole thing. Of course, it's like easy money, you know. There's whole markets that are about trading these secondary markets, leveraging them for all sorts of shit. And yeah, capital strike is one way to put it. I think maybe politically you could understand it as a capital strike, because if it becomes very clear that there are elements within the New York City specifically ruling class, finance, insurance and real estate sectors specifically, that want to see an end to this sort of social democratic polity that New York City is at this point in time. But more than that, I think maybe the primary consideration is whether or not you get paid back or not. And the city finances have been deteriorating for some time at this point.
Well, you know, either way, it's something of a crisis of confidence from the big bourgeoisie.
Right, yeah, the type that buys these bonds, you know, the types, not just that trades them, but the type that actually sits on them and owns them. And they, of course, get their advice from bond traders and, like, large institutional investors who, these are part of, like, broad funds that they invest their things in. So there's, like, a kind of, like, feedback loop between what the big banks and what the hedge funds, what the investment, let's call them technicians, think, and then where the capital ends up going.
So when you bring up 74, you're not saying that there's been a moment like this recently. It's just that there's some rumblings online that maybe we're heading towards something like that, where people are no longer interested in buying U.S. bonds, taking on U.S. debt.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think that we haven't reached that 74 moment, but it's like maybe 1973 is what these people are arguing, which is that the the market is getting a little skittish right now about U.S. debt, which would, of course, this was supposed to be the safest asset in the world. It was up until several years ago. And so huge sea change in terms of U.S. power and ability to, you know, spread that power all over the world.
Were this to come to pass, it sounds like what Trump is trying to do is sort of a play to restore that confidence is, one, massive deregulation, like the really it's the devolution revolution that the Republicans have talked about since the 90s is absolutely happening now. And then, yeah, these sort of imperialist, irredentist ideas of taking Greenland and Canada and Panama, although we haven't heard much about that recently, I guess that might be some sort of signal of, you know, the whole Western Hemisphere is going to be open for a U.S.-led feeding frenzy. And then I think, you know, another aspect of this play is what we're seeing with the ICE raids in terms of not only is it disciplining of American labor, you know, a crucial manual labor sector of the American working class, undocumented labor, but then also with this raid at a Chicago apartment building last week, this horrific Black Hawk helicopter raid where they arrested everyone in the building and checked their papers and
children thrown naked into the streets. It was
horrific. You know, these are counterinsurgency tactics. It's in the name of cleaning up gangs, but it's directed against the American people, the American working class, including undocumented people. But what does that do for capital? Well, apparently this building has been going through a contentious court hearings about its debt. And, you know, the tenants have stood strong and tried to stay in the building and fight to stay there. And there's some speculation that the building's owner called ICE to demand this raid in order to reclaim the building in order to win the court case.
It's interesting, even if that's not the case. Like, if that is the case and I believe it, then I think we could all kind of recognize the confluence of the power of capital, the power of developer, landowner, building owner in this case. And then I hesitate to even call ICE at this point the state. It's kind of, you mentioned gangs and gang warfare. It's like it's almost like a parastatal organization, I feel like. ICE operating under rules of engagement, if we can call them, that are far more like Fallujah, you know, than Chicago. And I think that there's something important about that. But like, even if that's just a rumor, like the effects are the same, right? There is like a way in which the terror is kind of the point, and the way in which like suppressing these people, repressing and oppressing these people is like beneficial for all sorts of powerful actors within Chicago and present like the larger American economy too, which I think is your point, right? Which is like these disciplining measures are not merely enforcement mechanisms being visited upon like undocumented immigrants or illegal immigrants, whatever they call them, but are part of a more like broader campaign against the working class in general, right? In order to increase precarity and exploitability.
Law and order too is a big hand in that, because if you know, since 2020, there's been this immense sort of scare about crime, and a big part of that is homelessness or just or the tightened labor market after the pandemic, you know, the great resignation, this idea that maybe the working class is kind of fed up with playing by the system's rules. They're losing their good Protestant work ethic, and they're shoplifting or whatever these people think, you know, they're selling stuff on Instagram. Law and order is, I think, this fantasy that everybody will be put back in their place, where, you know, the boss is the boss and the worker is the worker again. That's kind of part of the appeal to all of this stuff. But then, you know, combined with everything else, combined with the tariffs, just the political crisis in general, the shock of watching this all happen, it does make America look like it's just a sinking ship. Like, it's, you know, people have been talking about civil war for so long, you know, Tim Pool and people on the left as well. I mean, this is something like a civil war, except it's kind of, it's only on one side. It's like It's like a counter-insurrection against an insurrection that never happened.
Right, right.
Or I guess you could call it like an insurrection against the knock-on effects of the George Floyd uprising at best.
Right, just like we had a Red Scare without like a rise in communist organization like 3, 4, 5 years ago, right? There's like, it's weird that all these levers are getting pulled, and it's weird that crime is being trotted out. We all have seen the statistics, right? We know that crime is not even close to where it was in the 1960s or 70s, let alone the 1990s. And so like, we have to search for another reason why this rhetoric is being applied. And it's not merely cynical. I think a lot of it is really cynical. It's being used as this sort of this cudgel. And we are now, 2 weeks into the new name of our podcast. I didn't realize this, but the order that Trump gave outlawing Antifa and domestic, or calling it a domestic terrorist organization, wasn't a mere executive order. It was like a presidential memorandum, of which there's only been 7 in U.S. history.
Yeah, it's a national security order.
Right, which is wild. Like, this is so far because the Congress seems to have completely abrogated its role as a branch of the government. The judiciary seems to have rolled over largely, although I guess we'll see where all this stuff comes from the Supreme Court. But the Antifa memorandum might be the most portentous piece of political activity that Trump has undertaken so far in this second term.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it could serve as an extension of the sort of war on undocumented people, the political aspect of it that began with the arrest of Mahmoud Khalil,
yeah.
Extending that to U.S. citizens, you know, and of course the extension as well of counterterrorism, not only past the bounds of, you know, its traditional place during the war on terror against Islamism, but then to drug traffickers in the case of Venezuela and possibly Mexico, and then just dissidents of capitalism, of the state.
Yeah, along with, as you said earlier, this attempt to shift the rules of engagement with the military. I don't know if you've been following, the United States is practically blockading Venezuela right now. Much of our Atlantic fleet seems to be parked off of Venezuela, and they're just blowing up speedboats, you know.
Right.
Presumably they claim that they have evidence that these are Trende Aragua narco terrorists or whatever, but none has been presented to us whatsoever.
No, it's also directed by the same person who's doing who made the Antifa memorandum, Stephen Miller. It's his call on both ends.
Right. So this the second Trump 2.0 has seen really the most frightening and shittiest and most craven and deranged members of the MAGA movement, which is to say Stephen Miller. Like, this man is truly fucked up. And Tom Homan, right, that's the guy's name, the guy in charge of ICE, truly a violent and detestable person, someone who seems to actually get a rise out of the cruelty of immigration policy. These people were kind of in the back room, they were backbenchers in Trump 1.0, but Trump 2.2, it seems like they've been, raised up into basically the front seats, the front rows of power.
Yep. You know, there were some scary people in Trump 1.0. Steve Bannon was just as much a Nazi as Stephen Miller. But then that sort of wing of the coalition sort of fell apart due to the resistance, but also largely due to capitalists being really worried about Trump's trade war. And I think that that's got to be underway now as these tariffs sort of spiral out. We start to see the effects of them. Trump keeps passing new ones. And so I'm kind of waiting for the capitalists to really rein him in, but I haven't seen too much evidence of that. It seems like they're mostly reining in the Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Democrats, Republicans, big capitalists, small capitalists, middle class, working class, everybody kind of got the sense when Trump was reelected that like resisting the way that resistance happened in Trump 1.0 was not going to cut it this time around, and that it was a meager mandate, but that there was a mandate of sorts for change, right? I think that there were all sorts of articles that came out in between the election and Trump's inauguration. There was all the fretting about Project 2025. There was all this sense that Trump had learned his lessons from the first term and created this like lean, mean, policy-driven fighting machine that was going to be able to, using like expert opinions on, say, tariff policy under the McKinley administration, was going to be able to come in and like seriously rejigger the way that global trade works, that American industrial policy works, that immigration works in this country, and that it was going to be part of a kind of holistic plan that was going to use what leverage America has left in order to reindustrialize this country and seriously change the way that the political economy works. And we just haven't seen that. We've seen tariffs introduced fitfully. We've seen negotiations not on some strategic level, but very like kind of one man driven Donald Trump himself.
Very emotional.
Very emotional, flitting from like event to event, completely reactive. We saw I don't know if we talked about this, but like we saw a trade war with China, which America got its ass kicked like almost off the bat. You remember with the rare earth stuff, right? This was several months ago, where basically the American auto industry, let alone our military industrial complex, began to shut down within a couple weeks of China no longer providing or agreeing to trade rare earths with the United States. So fitfully, like all across the spectrum, this Trump administration has been a chaotic failure. And so we're in a dangerous moment right now. I think a very dangerous moment right now, because the levers that are left to pull, because the violence can be to an extent turned outwards towards Iran, towards Venezuela. And that works to a certain extent to kind of get people's minds and attention elsewhere, to blow up, to kill innocent or non-innocent people in order to get that kind of frisson that something is happening within this administration. But like really turning inwards, turning the violence against immigrants, turning the violence against Antifa, is a way, I think, to salvage what has been so far, how many months in, 9 months in, an utter failure of a presidency. And I think the attempts to try to salvage it will only become more deranged as the economic conditions continue to deteriorate, as I think we're seeing they are right now.
Well, you know, from capital's perspective, the deregulation and the tax cuts are a huge win. And there was some speculation after that, because the Epstein stuff started to come out after that. There's some speculation like, oh, the capitalist class is pushing the Epstein stuff now. You saw the Democrats start to push it too, because they're ready to rein in Trump and this is how they're going to do it. They've got this in their back pocket to do it. That's kind of the game that's going on right now, is will the capitalist class be able to reassert some control via the Democratic Party or even via the Republicans, if there's some split between him and the Republicans, which it's hard to imagine, but it's happened before? Or are the Republicans going to go with this idea that like the tariffs will replace taxation and America will become this libertopia where you can just put a factory wherever you want? It's totally deregulated. You can do whatever you want on it. Everyone has to do what you say, because they're all dying. I guess that's the game. But you have a solution.
Me personally?
Yeah.
I guess I do have a solution. The solution is for Trump's gangrenous left or right arm to to spread the poison of sepsis through his body and destroy him, which might be happening as we speak. People say that he's acting more and more off. So maybe the solution presents itself in like just the natural or unnatural death of the POTUS. But you're talking about my essay that I wrote.
Yes.
So this essay that I just published on Sunday is called Gadsden's Over Rio, The Left Wing of Winning Back the Republic. It can be found on my Substack blog, seankb.substack.com. We'll put links in that show description over there.
All right. So we're going to hear your essay, and then we will be back after the paywall to discuss it. I certainly have some thoughts, some questions. If you want to hear that part, the discussion of the essay, go to patreon.com/thiswreckage and sign up for $5, $10, or for free. Or if you want to get a book mailed to you, you can sign up at the $10 annual level. You get a 16% discount when you do that, and I'll send you Jared Shanahan's Every Fire Needs a Little Bit of Help. And at the $15 level, if you sign up at that annual level or upgrade to it, I'll send you Jared's book, and I'll send you I Want to Believe, my book about Posadism.
Yes.
How does that sound?
Sounds awesome, man. That sounds great. Let's do this essay, and then we'll see you folks on the other side.
All right.
All right. Here is my essay, Gadsden's Over Rio, The Left Wing of Winning Back the Republic. October 5th, 2025. Something global is happening. Make America Great Again flags fly over evangelical churches in Central America. Gadsden's flags, Don't Tread on Me, wave over Rio de Janeiro. A sign outside Australian Parliament reads, Overgoverned, overtaxed, overrun. We need a fix like 1776. Seems strange, no? At first glance, there's something postmodern and absurd about this play of signifiers across protests by various populations fighting for what seems like very different things. But surely hundreds of millions of people all over the globe mean something when they fly these flags. What would it look like to take these ostensibly ridiculous statements seriously, to interrogate what they mean at this historical juncture? The fact is that the international system that we grew up with and took to be something akin to a force of nature is in deep crisis. The material underpinnings for United States hegemony are crumbling across the globe. There is a tendency to see this as a geopolitical problem, the rise of a multipolar world which might bring needed counterbalance to the overweening power of U.S. finance capital within a perpetual order of sovereign, mutually independent nation states. But I would argue that the issues at work and the consequences of this crisis are far greater than a shift in foreign policy or the locus of international power. What is crumbling at this historical juncture is an entire imperial system at home and abroad, one that overthrew the American Republic back at the beginning of the 20th century and advanced an apparatus of tyranny throughout the Cold War, whose legacy we live with today. The Republic was overthrown because the threat of proletarian socialism in the U.S. and abroad necessitated. Wearing the badge of progressivism and organized labor, it smothered the independent workers' movement with the modern welfare state. Federal policies were put in place to serve as counter-tendencies to the concentration of and combination of capital, while the concentration and combination of legally sanctioned workers' associations led to their subordination under the Democratic Party. The reactionary middle classes, facing their ruin, erected an entire edifice, an undemocratic administrative state housed within the executive branch, populated by hand-picked experts, to turn back the clock and ensure that small property, whether petty capital or educational credentials, could reproduce itself. This Bonapartist state at home was then unleashed abroad in the ideological battle against the Soviet Union and the Cold War. After 1991, it morphed into an entire ersatz civil society of non-governmental organization tied to one or both of the capitalist political parties in the United States and their branches in Europe.
In the context of a dying imperial project, we need a fix like 1776 in a Commonwealth country like Australia isn't so absurd after all. It is no surprise that these mantles are being borne abroad, as the U.S. War for Independence was the most substantive bourgeois revolution in history, with a long and checkered afterlife. What we are seeing, and what we ignore at our peril, is that there is a growing international Republican movement afoot. They set their movement against what they call globalism. They call for people power against the elite. They want to take back sovereignty of nations and control of borders, which is to say that currently the global Republican movement has only a right wing. This confuses middle-class intellectuals who have been created by the imperial project that overthrew the Republic. But if anyone still believes in small-r Republican ideals like non-domination by state and private actors, civil liberties, and substantive independence, it's the working classes in the capitalist core. By contrast, the so-called left has long since acquiesced to the death of the Republic, despite Marxism's undeniable radical Republican roots. We who form the core of the Independent Labor Club of North America were born and raised in the shadow of the imperial state that is now in crisis all around us. Let the middle classes mourn the Bonapartist state, and let the capitalists try to patch the rules-based international order back together to make it great again. The second chaotic term of the Trump administration is a last toss of the die by a political class hemmed in on all sides by crisis. It is not our job to save the American empire from itself, but to articulate the way in which we, the working classes, are the historical heirs to the great revolutionary projects of the 18th and 19th centuries. Building a left wing of winning back the Republic is not about appealing to MAGA workers by tailing the reactionary right. It's about building an explicitly proletarian wing of the already existing global Republican movement. Regardless, if Trump 2.0 is any indication, the political program of the right-wing middle class is dead in the water. It's just not possible at this late date to raise small property up to prominence again, not least because the center of global value production no longer resides in the middle-class reactionary socialist collective West, but increasingly in East Asia. Against the anti-globalists, xenophobic, Christian fundamentalist, nationalist, petty bourgeois, right-wing republicanism, we must counterpose a solidaristic, secular, internationalist, working-class republicanism. The latter has deep roots in North America, going back to the working-class movements like the Knights of Labor in the 19th century. The Independent Labor Club is not the political expression of left-wing republicanism itself, but the potential connective tissue of a broader working class movement for class independence on Republican terms that must necessarily cohere itself in civil society before it can take on an independent political form. We don't choose politics. Politics chooses us. In the era of Clinton and Obama, we were trying to work within progressivism to make it social democratic again. In the era of Trump, we must work within the battle against the Bonapartist state empire to make the Republican movement socialist again, to posit the working classes as heirs to a revolutionary legacy around which all politics still rotates. Our allegiance isn't to the flag or the country for which it stands, but to the historical process of political freedom inaugurated by the rise of bourgeois civil society and the abolition of feudal social relations as recognized by Marx and Engels as the precondition for working class self-activity. The petty bourgeoisie can be easily organized for their reactionary vision of the Republic because production already organizes them, and the ideology of Americanism holds them up as the arbiters of social freedom. It is not so easy for us. But the common sense small-r republicanism of the working class is a premise already existing, already in existence, but an ideal to which those who claim to be socialists will have to adjust themselves. Socialist workers building the civil-social preconditions for a social republican proletarian party and or revolutionary international union is the pre-political struggle that the Independent Labor Club sets before itself. Marxists are essential for building the preconditions for independent politics because it's only they who take the working class seriously as the subject of history. However, the aggregation of all the Marxists in North America under one banner would not be a substitute for a mass movement, let alone a mass party. The first step is to build an organization that might express the fractures and fissures within the class of which it is composed, so that the problems of class unity and class self-activity can be worked out in practice. All the radical phraseology and learned lessons of the 20th century will prove useless if left in the hands of socialist intellectuals. What the ILC intends to do is build the institutional conditions necessary for a left, right, and center of the working class movement to rise again. If Marxists have what it takes to lead a movement of millions, then so be it, but that leadership must be earned, not given. By organizing ourselves in this pre-political capacity to build the left wing of republicanism, we are entering a fraught and terrifying battle, but we have no choice if we are to be at all relevant and to stop the march of right-wing petty bourgeois reaction in its place. Radicals need to leave the cocoon of the late 20th century and move into the 21st. We can't pretend we have a movement. We have to build one fit for the stakes of today. And it has to be built from the ground up, chapter by chapter. One advantage of fighting on the terrain of the Social Republic is that it automatically excludes Popular Front forces and progressives themselves. This is a good thing because we need to make explicit a split that has been implicit since the New Deal coalition started to fray in the mid-20th century. Our path begins by recognizing that there is more potential in a Gadsden flag flying over Rio de Janeiro than with another vote to preserve an imperial edifice in terminal decline. We have to deal with society and politics as they actually exist, not as we wish them to be. The international battle to win back the Republic needs a left wing, and the Independent Labor Club intends to help build it.